Well, Albert Einstein once said that since time begins to slow down with higher speeds, it can be shown that at the speed of light, it stops totally, and beyond that, begins to run backwards. Similarly, matter having contracted more and more ultimately vanishes. But beyond the speed of light, it is difficult to imagine negative matter with infinite mass. Einstein was probably right when he said that the speed of light was the upper limiting velocity in the universe. Notice how he said probably right. Or was he? In a moment, our guest David Sirita on Coast to Coast AM. David Sirita's first aspiration in life was to become an astronaut. In 1968, David and a friend witnessed a UFO along with hundreds of other witnesses. After this experience, David grew up as a UFO enthusiast, never living in doubt of the phenomena that has swept the world since the Roswell incident of 1947. His interest in space, religion, philosophy, astronomy, and science led him on his career in related fields. He has worked deeply in high technology, on environmental and humanitarian issues, and as a professional photographer for more than 20 years. He has studied world religion, science, physics, and paranormal psychology for more than 25 years. His book, Evidence, The Case for NASA UFOs, he is our guest on Coast to Coast. Back again. Hi, David. How are you?
Hi, George. It's been since the Mexican UFO incident that we've...
I remember that.
Been on the air together.
Well. What have you been up to in the months?
Well, actually, just recently, in the last year, I've been filming out in New Mexico projects that a 9,000 square foot building that is solar powered, has its own wind power and its own hydrogen refueling station. It's kind of a demonstration to the world that you can have your home produce no global warming greenhouse gases and drive your car, do everything you normally do, including, you know, plasma screen TVs, computers, washer and dryer. It even collects its own rainwater from the roof, so it's kind of like a model, educational model building out there, and I've been doing all the filming on it. And even your last guest that was just on, I just filmed a guy out in New Mexico who has what's called gasification of garbage. He can actually extract hydrogen and propane out of garbage and produce no harmful emissions and produce energy with garbage, and the residual is just ash. And he's got a small plant out in New Mexico that produces up to 2 megawatts, which can power several hundred homes. So it's kind of a way to get rid of our solid waste problem and produce energy at the same time. So there's a lot of different technologies for the planet I've been kind of doing these short little films on lately. So.
Well, you know, David, it's not a topic at hand, but since you brought it up, it is the wave of the future, and I think the future is now. The question is, will it really ever happen?
Mm-hmm.
Will people force the issue to do things like that? I mean, I've always wondered, why can't we have self-contained homes like you just mentioned?
Actually, I lived in one for a year, and it's amazing. You know, when you have your TV and you have your toaster and everything, and it's all working on solar panels, and you get your own water from the rainwater, and it's incredible. I mean, it all works. Everything that we normally enjoy. I even had wireless high-speed internet and a phone. In fact, that's where I did the last show with you, was from the wireless internet phone in the middle of this airship in the New Mexican desert. And all of it's working perfectly. So I think as more people know about these things, they will eventually go in that direction. Also, if you consider disasters like we just had, obviously from the hurricane, that decentralizing power and having it in your own home doesn't make you a victim to a power plant going down. You still have all your systems up and running, and you just have to repair them locally rather than rely on the city to bring back your power and your water. So there's advantages in many ways to having systems like that. So that's kind of what I've been up to in the last year, plus evolving my physics theories and UFO propulsion theories along with my spiritual practice. So,
well, you know, you're kind of a different guy because you kind of blend physics and mm-hmm. spirituality mm-hmm. and episodes of real life all into one. You toss it into the pot. Not a lot of people do that. When I led into you with some verbiage from Albert Einstein as he talked about his theories of light and speed and time, you've looked at this too, haven't you?
Oh, extremely deeply. I mean, I mean, just to even think, I mean, just go back to, and this is a spiritual model, the Book of Enoch, which is the first prophet in the Bible, where this, what appears to be a spaceship, lands upon the earth. And as Enoch approaches this disc, he sees the Archangel Gabriel and Michael side by side, not gazing directly upon the face of the Supreme Being or God on the ship. And it's so powerful as he approaches that he falls upon his face and he enters. And eventually, as they start moving, he sees stars running by through the roof, which means they're going at amazing speeds. But if you consider that if God was limited to the speed of light in a spaceship, how slowly and how inefficient the Supreme Being would be at getting anywhere. I mean, we consider our nearest galaxy is Andromeda. It's 2.2 million light years away from us. I mean, that's just too slow to rely on the speed of light. But I think Einstein is correct, absolutely, that mass, and I have discussed this many times on many of the shows I've done with Art and also with you, it cannot attain the speed of light, but you can transform mass. And if you transform mass and you actually understand it on a quantum level, how you can reduce the mass gravity effect towards this mystique zero point, eventually, mass, spaceship, and pilot start to become lighter and lighter and lighter in relation to gravity. And eventually, they become so light as photons, you can do the speed of light on tiny amounts of energy rather than encountering the inertia that increases your mass to these enormous limits where you just can't move.
Is it the inertia that prevents
us
then?
I mean, inertia, just like, I mean, this is really simple to understand. I mean, imagine as you move a boat through water, the boat requires propulsion energy to move the boat through the water, but the faster you move the boat, the water impedes on the boat, making it heavier in resistance to the water. So it takes more and more energy to make the boat go millimeters faster because it keeps getting heavier and heavier and heavier in relation to the water. Now, when you move a jet through air mass, it's the same except you can go faster, but eventually the air mass impedes aircraft, slowing it down, increasing its weight charge in relation to that, and therefore the heavier it gets, the more and more energy it takes, and also you encounter what are known as G-forces, which become even more difficult, because as you start to try to make turns, the G-forces get so heavy they also increase your mass. So then, when you go through space, and initially Einstein thought the void of space was a void, that there was actually nothing in it. And Max Planck, the godfather of quantum physics in 1900, said that the void of space was supercharged with energy. And Einstein initially disagreed, but 10 years later, that's a long time, he reversed his decision and said that Planck was right, that there's an enormous amount of energy in the background of space. And if there's energy in an Einstein equation, there has to be mass, because mass and energy are equivalent in equals mc squared. So that would mean that, again, you're pushing through the mass of the background of space, and that resistance and inertia, you can go faster, much faster than through air mass, but still it slows you down, it weighs you down, and then you have to deal with things like G-forces. And even subtle turns doing one-tenth the speed of light, would say, let's just give an exotic number. There are actually nuclear fuels on Earth today that could produce velocities that fast. Helium-3 is one of them. And that's about 67 million miles per hour. If you had to even turn out of the way for an asteroid or an incoming piece of space debris that would destroy your ship, the G-forces will kill you. They'll destroy your ship and destroy you.
Oh, sure, yeah.
All of George Lucas's spaceships, like the Millennium Falcon and Star Wars, are a lot of fun for the eye and entertainment. But in reality, you can't suddenly do warp drive. A drive that powerful would just destroy the ship and destroy the pilots, and everything would just fall to pieces. But if you do the opposite, if you consider even spiritual models where, I mean, even look at the resurrection of Christ, that he transformed flesh, physical corporeal matter, into light, and then he was able to move around the universe with that new transformed body of light. And I think that's the way some of the more advanced UFOs are working.
What was it, David? What was it, though, that got Einstein to change his ideas 10 years later?
I think it was because initially he did think the void was this you know, subliminal layer of our universe, that substratum that had literally was so pure and so fine that everything else, you know, all of the mass rested in it. But when he really looked at it very closely, when he looked at Planck's equations, you have to remember, physicists, and I've been around them my whole life, all these Nobel Prize-winning physicists from MIT, I've worked on nuclear fusion, I worked on bomb detection, what they do is argue. There is no theory in physics today that is accepted 100% absolutely. Now, Einstein may be sitting at around 99% or 99.99% for a long period of history, but then it will change. Someone will come along with something that challenges it. But I think he really is right. I think it's just that he had to look at the idea of the transformation of mass, that if you look at it on a quantum level, where I'm starting to find now actual evidence in quantum models from Nobel Prize-winning physicists in their rejected papers, where you can see evidence of what I'm talking about, that you can actually, that mass is not a constant. Light, as we know, is not a constant. Time is not a constant, as we know from Einstein, and that all of these things can be transformed. They can change. They can undergo transformation. So I propose that there's no way when you consider the movements of UFOs, sudden stops and sudden turns at extremely high velocities, the G-forces would destroy the pilots, destroy the craft, that the only way you could structurally survive turns, sudden turns like that would be if you were a zero-mass gravity effect craft. And I didn't just look at that generally, theoretically. I had to start looking at quantum models, the atom and smaller, and trying to find out where I could find evidence of this. Because if you could prove it on that level, you could scale it up to the level of a spaceship, and eventually we could reverse engineer this kind of technology and start moving around our universe. And that's kind of where I started. But what I started to discover as I looked at quantum models and I correlated it with my years and years of spiritual study, I saw a pattern, a very distinct pattern. And the first thing you find is, I mean, if you go to the book of Genesis and the Garden of Eden, this is actually an amazing parable, both in physics and in spirituality. But you look at what that God had warned that Adam and Eve should never partake of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, for in the day they do, they will surely die. Now, that sounds like, you know, a temptation. And most theologists actually inadvertently take the side of the devil by believing it's good to know the difference between good and evil. But if you really look at what it is, the entire thing without separating it, good and evil is a conflict. It's two forces competing against each other and canceling each other out in the form of a conflict. Now, if a single individual ingests good and evil, what they normally do, what I normally do when I have a problem or a conflict is I try to solve it. And what we do, we define good and we define evil egotistically. And that's fine if there's only one person on the earth, but there are literally billions of people on the earth now. And what the problem is, when each person egotistically decides what is good and what is evil, they disagree. Some agree, and they form large congregation or thought bodies or religions that agree with each other, saying, my interpretation of the Bible or of the Quran or of the Old Testament or the Dhammapada in Buddhism, or you even look at the Hindu Bhagavad Gita, what you find is every religion has literally hundreds of divisions because of the fact that they don't agree on all the points, major points and minor points, and eventually they schism or split off into different schools, like Christianity has and like all the great religions have. So what good and evil does is it proves itself to always be a conflict. You solve the conflict, you define it, but yet everyone defines it differently, so they argue, and their arguments lead eventually to wars and even fanatical holy wars, like we're dealing with terrorism, where one religion thinks their religion is superior to ours, or as Islamic people think, many think, because I know I've studied it when I was in Saudi Arabia, that they even believe that they have interpreted Christianity better than Americans have, and therefore they're more holy than we are. And they hold that against us. So what good and evil does, what God was actually saying is that this, don't ever take in this knowledge because it's conflict. It's poison. It will always divide your mind into two. Now, just hold that thought for a moment. Just think of good
and evil. Because I want to see how you're going to blend
this. Yeah, how I'm going to blend it into physics.
With
now,
physics.
Look, when subatomic physicists are looking at the particles, atoms themselves, just on a simplistic level, you look at a hydrogen atom, which is the primary atom in creation. You have hydrogen and helium are the two fuels that fuse in our sun. You have a proton spinning positive clockwise, and you have an electron spinning negative. That's positive and negative. Most physicists say that the atom is basically inert magnetically. It has no magnetism or even no electromagnetism overall because those two forces cancel each other out. If two people are pulling on a rope in opposite directions, with the exact same force, they cancel out the overall force to zero. And that's essentially what is happening in our consciousness. Because of this conflict state that we have ingested spiritually, we live in this state of conflict that cancels out most of our energy. Now, if you look deeper into the atom, you find that the electron has an anti-electron, which is electron spins negative, anti-electron spins positive.
Positive, right.
And then you have proton, anti-proton. And then you have quark, anti-quark. And then it gets smaller. You get into taus, anti-taus, leptons, muons. It just keeps going smaller and smaller, and all of them are in the same dual pairedness that happened in consciousness with the proverbial fall from the Garden of Eden.
Almost like you must have yin and yang and
exactly.
positive, negative.
But the question is, now, this is the amazing thing. Where did all this start? Where did this duality, where was it born from? And if we look at all of the great teachers from Jesus Christ to Buddha to Muhammad to, I mean, all of them. I mean, you can go, you know, Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita, they all speak, and I will use even the Bible here. We speak of Jesus when he says in the Gospel of Matthew that if thine eye becomes single, thy whole body shall be filled with light. Now, let's look at that statement and correlate it to physics, too, because in all of physics, of every particle we know of, every wave-particle relationship, because all particles are just particles in wave relationships, light is the only particle that we initially know is single. It has no antiparticle paired with it that we can identify yet, although we're going to get much deeper into this later in the discussion. So light, in essence, is single. It actually spins positive versus negative. So light is the only particle we know of also that can move at this amazing velocity, 186,282 miles per second, which comes to 670 million miles per hour.
Now, nothing else really comes close to it.
Nothing else that we know of yet really comes close to it. But when we look at that and we think, wow, that's so instantaneous over short distances, and light, in all of Einstein's relativity, we rely on light to tell us what is happening in a particular event. Now, let's look at an event, even a small-scale event. Two people are watching a car accident, and one of them is 100 yards away from the accident, and one of them is 10 feet away from the accident.
Mm-hmm.
In the same moment in time, the person who's 200 yards away from it is not seeing the same thing the person is 10 yards away from it, or 10 feet away from it, because we're relying on a velocity, which is a limitation, to witness that event. And when we expand that out into the universe, we think of even our closest star systems, Alpha Centauri A and B, are 4.2 and 4.3 light years from here. We're not seeing them in real time. We're seeing them as the light left them 4.3 years ago.
I'm sure there are stars we're looking at now that have already burned out.
They've already burned out, and galaxies that may not even exist anymore. I mean, Andromeda is 2.2 million years light years away from us. So when an astronomer looks at it, they're almost looking at a why, something that is not actually happening right now. So what we actually have to start to get into to find out where we are today in science, you know, we can drive down the freeway at 100 miles an hour for breaking the speed limit. We can travel on the space shuttle at 18,000 miles an hour around the Earth. The speed of light is 76 million miles per hour. We're very far away from that, but even worse, when we consider the idea of becoming so free that we can move anywhere in our universe in zero time, all of our theories in physics so far don't get us anywhere near that.
Hold that thought, David. Hold that thought, because we'll be right back with you on Coast to Coast AM. Now, if you listen to Coast on your regular radio, that is great, but StreamLink will also allow you to take podcasts and to have some fun and to do chats with us. once a month with me and then once a month with a guest. It's just a great addition to what you listen to on a regular basis. Very affordable, pennies a day. If you want more information on Streamlink, just go to the coasttocoastam.com website. And we'll be back in a moment with our special guest, David Sirita, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, David Sirita, our guest. David, I assume with this tie-in between physics and spirituality, we're also involving time travel. Is that true?
Well, that's going to become very clear. Actually, where we're headed towards tonight is the ultimate theory in physics, which is called singularity. And it was my friend Luke Gatto who had fed me a physics paper that sat on my shelf for about a year before I actually picked it up and read it last summer, and there it was in Paul Dirac's rejected paper written by Donald Hodgson on the Dirac's equation in the sea of negative energy was the proof that I was looking for 2 years, because after actually in the year 2001 when my book and film Evidence: The Case for NASA UFOs came out, I had demonstrated how spaceships could reduce their mass down towards zero. They could attain the speed of light and then break the speed of light. And I did that by reducing the mass gravity effect of a craft so low that eventually what starts to happen is as the frequency increases on mass so highly, it eventually is able to conquer the speed of light. And eventually there was another physicist named Zhao Mugwejo from Cambridge in England, who wrote a book called Faster Than the Speed of Light, published in 2003. When I actually looked in the details of how he finally broke the speed of light, it was identical to mine. He has a PhD in physics, and I, of course, have no PhD in physics, although I've studied physics for over 10 years.
Well, you know what you're talking about.
I put my time in, so I knew what I was talking about. But what ends up happening is I'm not satisfied with even 10 times the speed of light. Eventually, I was able to break our work paralleled where we broke the speed of light on what are known as really high-frequency quantum gravity waves. Eventually, I wasn't satisfied with that. I found another way to break the speed of light on low-frequency waves. But, you know, that stuff gets very complicated. And for those who are interested, I have a 60-page paper posted at AmericanAntiGravity.com for people who want to get really deep. But what I was looking for was something called singularity, something beyond.
And explain that. Yeah, tell me a definition of that.
Well, singularity is something that is when you end up finding out that what actually causes time to come into existence is that everything starts to actually slow down in the universe when this duality is born. When we have the proverbial fall from the Garden of Eden, we initially, according to the mystics, Jesus Christ and Buddha included, we came from the place of the one or singularity. They actually spoke about it. But what I was doing is looking for a place to prove this in physics. Did this place of singularity actually exist, and what could you attain once you were there? Well, it took me 2 years. I mean, I was looking everywhere. Is there something beyond the pairedness of waves? When you have a negative thought, a positive thought counteracts it, the two wrestle with each other, and eventually one of them wins, but the leftover energy is very, very weak, and it moves forward, or in some cases it actually moves in reverse. It moves backwards. Sometimes, you know, negativity wins, sometimes positivity wins. But overall, I could see the cause of inertia was that when a positive thought goes out or a positive energy goes out, it encounters its opposite, which slows it down. So when you actually look at waves in the quantum world and the atom and smaller, and even if you look at a hurricane is a giant wave formation that is a pairedness. You have the hurricane vortex itself, and it's moving through a resistance, which is another waveform, which is air mass and also the water. So I could see that everything was slowing down in the universe. Time was being born. But this place of singularity would be the ultimate place to arrive at, that these highest angelic UFOs, like the wheels of Ezekiel that appeared to the prophet Ezekiel,
yes,
the ship that appeared to Enoch, the ship that landed on the Sinai, the other phenomena that happen around Christ, and there are other phenomena, even in the Hindu Bhagavad Gita, they describe the intelligentsia from other planets who watched the Battle of Kurukshetra take place at the end of this great era.
Do you think those were natural events, by the way, David, or real extraterrestrial events?
No, I think they dealt with the same thing we're dealing with right now. There was an increase in the UFO phenomena. There's an increase in visitations today, just like there was at the end of the great cycle, the great yuga, where you had... It's actually quite amazing. If you read the Bhagavad Gita, and I've read the whole thing, it's so similar to the Bible in that Krishna is supposedly the incarnation of God in the highest. For the Hindus, he is. I don't mean that supposedly. There is a period where there's a great battle, which looks just like the prophesied Battle of Armageddon. And in the end of the battle, and during the battle, there are all these intelligentsia, all these spaceships watching from above. And then Krishna manifests in this blaze of light body, in this almost second coming of Krishna, and it marks the end of this great period, this great cycle.
Well, had the battle already begun, or was it prophecy for a battle in the future,
like the book of Revelation? The battle actually took place, and there, I was actually reading this, and I don't know the exact source, but they found a city in India where there was a high cancer rate, and they noticed when archaeologists dug under this city that they found a layer of radioactive ash several, you know, layers down in the Earth's mantle, and they were in the Earth's crust, and they found that this even distribution of ash could only, radioactive ash could have only been caused by a nuclear weapon. And this is in the Hindu Mahabharata, which is where they describe these great, almost nuclear type weapons that were detonated on the Earth.
Would a meteorite have done that, or an asteroid?
Left an even ash of a layer of ash without a crater, I doubt it. Without a crater.
Okay.
So anyway, it's possible, like the Hopi Indians say, that we're going through these great cycles where we seem to repeat the same thing every time. We develop nuclear weapons. We don't follow the path of using harmonious technologies for our planet. We can't get past this fossil fuels and these primitive nuclear fuels. And we don't seem to want to get on to higher technology. We're in that same place right now. Global warming is increasing the number of hurricanes and weather patterns on our planet. Now, we know that hurricanes have always happened, but not every year with this magnitude.
No, not like this. They're running out of names. I had a story on that first hour.
Oh, yeah, I saw that today.
Incredible.
I mean, all we have to do is we have to use, power homes with solar panels and wind power systems and use electric cars. I was down in Santa Monica filming last week a short film. Santa Monica City Hall has 14 Toyota RAV4 electric vehicles recharging on a garage roof full of solar panels, and their employees drive these things around all day. And they don't pollute, they don't produce any greenhouse gases, and they still get everything done that any human being has to get done.
Well, but if a calamity were to have occurred, I guess it would have had to have been millions of years ago, David, for there to be no remnants of these civilizations, right?
Yeah, that you would have to have an extinction-level event, whether we extincted ourselves through a war or, like the Hopi Indians say, that nature eventually gets so powerful their elders receive visions, just like Noah received a vision, and they go into retreat, whether in Noah's case, of course, he builds the ship. But if the Hopis go into the mesas, into the caves, and they wait for the great cycle to pass, and then another cycle starts. And then they say we may have had Mu and Lemuria, Atlantis and Lemuria, and Mu, and that was another great cycle. But we don't seem to be getting it right each time. The answers are there. You know, we instead of riding a bicycle to the corner store that doesn't pollute, we would rather take our Hummer or a big, you know, four-wheel drive just to the corner store. And that, until every individual on this planet is willing to make that commitment, these hurricanes are just going to get worse and worse and worse. When are we going to actually wake up? So to me, you know, all the advent of the massive increase of sightings of UFOs, it seems so similar to what was written in the Bhagavad Gita thousands of years ago. And also if we look back to the time of Moses and God appearing on the Sinai, I'm just beckoned with the thought. I just can't accept that God travels in a spaceship at the speed of light, because for one, God would be caught in time. as he approaches the speed of light, time slows down. So for him, it takes forever to get here. And then all of a sudden, he's got to turn around and go somewhere else. It doesn't work.
No, it's not going to happen that way.
But singularity answers all of these problems. You will, when you come to the point of singularity, you eventually see how time is born. It's instantaneously possible to move through any point in time because all of them exist for you at the same moment in singularity.
But how do you merge, then, the physics and the spirituality in order to create singularity?
Once you understand that all inertia or slowing down or resistance is caused by the dual pairedness of reality, and that when Jesus said, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light, first we think, okay, light should be instantaneous. We should be able to detect all events in the universe in real time by some phenomena. But light as we know it can't do it. It's too slow. So what is light pushing up against that's slowing it down? And then we find Einstein's cosmological constant, which is actually the background substratum of space, which produces negative pressure against light. So light has to move through that substratum.
So are you saying that if light didn't have this negative pressure against it, it would go even faster?
It would go way faster. In fact, if it didn't encounter its inertia, light is for us is the ultimate velocity. But there may be a light, and we're gonna get into this, that is truly beyond the light that we know, and that is called singularity. So there I was, kind of stuck. I mean, you need to be able to answer this. You need to be able to prove that singularity exists. Right now, the term singularity is used for black holes, which is the point where both sides of the black hole theoretically touch each other, and they cancel each other out. They become one. Instead of the wave being dual-paired, positive and negative in a spin, they touch. But many physicists argue that that just goes into a microscopic or you go into the micro-universe, and that spiral just gets smaller and smaller and smaller towards infinity, and they never touch. Well, the first thing that Paul Dirac discovered that got my attention in this paper by Donald Hodson on Paul Dirac's equation in the Sea of Negative Energy, which was rejected, and Paul Dirac won the Nobel Prize in the 1930s. So you know this man is brilliant, but I was interested in the paper because it was rejected, and I have this strong belief that if physicists today cannot answer the most complex questions, then the most complex problems, both of them, questions and problems, then there must be something in the rejected material that they missed. So when I read the paper, thanks to my friend Luke Gatto, and this paper is available at Zeitlin.net on the Internet, Zeitlin.net, if people want to get really deep and read this. The first thing Paul Dirac discovered that really captivated my attention is he saw pairs of atoms, electron anti-electrons, pairs of electrons spinning, and he's actually seeing them being born from high-frequency light waves and then disappearing back into them. So it was the first proof in a quantum model that matter was born from light, the dual pairedness of mass, and then that mass could disappear, which means reduce its mass down to zero and become light again. And that was the first revelation that I saw. The second one that I saw that really got my attention is he actually follows this pair of electron-anti-electron pairs that were stripped off of a proton. So they're not spinning around the heavy core of the atom anymore. And normally, like planets, the electron actually orbits around the solid mass of the proton. It's like a gravity relationship that binds it in that orbit. It's spinning around it in a random orbit. But when you strip it off the proton, it has nothing to orbit around, so it starts to spiral into smaller and smaller orbits, which means, in my theory, its frequency is increasing and its mass is reducing. And it gets to the point where they just disappear. And Paul Dirac said that mainstream physicists said they couldn't see them anymore. They normally you take these photographs in what are called bubble chambers, mm-hmm, or spark chambers. And spark chambers were invented when, you know, imagine yourself, you know, 100 years ago when you see a foggy day in San Francisco, you pick up a rock and you throw it through the fog and it leaves a trail in the fog. So physicists realized they could actually take pictures of the motions that particles make in what are called bubble chambers, where you fill the bubble chamber with gas you explode the subatomic particles in the gas field, and the particles leave trails in the vapor, and you can photograph those trails and follow the wave patterns. The only thing they can't see in a bubble chamber is light, because it has no mass. It passes through solid matter. It doesn't interact with it the way that physical objects do. So they could see the trails that electrons made in the bubble chamber, but when they went really high frequency, they disappeared. They couldn't see them anymore, which means they didn't have mass anymore. So what mainstream physicists said is matter and antimatter met up and annihilated. But Paul Dirac said impossible. He debated it. He said they actually never met up with each other at all, because he did the quantum measurements using, you know, Planck lengths, which is the smallest measurement we have to measure events in the quantum world right now. So he said there's no way they met up. And if they did, there would be an explosion that you could actually photograph. And there was no explosion. So that was the second piece of evidence I found. But then the whole emphasis of Dirac's paper is what is called the equation of the sea of negative energy. Now, this is not to be mixed up with negative spiritual energy or...
Like energy zappers, people like that.
Yeah, or nothing like that. Or it's not to be equated with what's called dark matter or negative matter.
Okay.
This is a substratum to our entire universe that everything in it is singularly charged, single. It has no antiparticle anywhere inside of that whole substratum. It's all one. And what Dirac found was that when he followed the path of the highest frequency wave particles, which are gamma waves, he found that out of gammas, he could see the birth of electron-anti-electron pairs. And then he saw them go back into it. So when he followed the trail into it, he found that everything in that, where those particles were going, was single. There was no more duality in this substratum, in this field. You can call it positively charged or negatively charged, it doesn't matter. And when you really get that, I knew before I even read the next paragraph, I said, oh my God, this is it. This is what I've been looking for 2 years. This is the place of singleness that all the great masters spoke about, where there is no duality. And if there's no duality, there's no inertia. There's no resistance. That means if you enter it, you have to become single to enter it. And if you actually enter it, you are everywhere in the entire universe in zero time, because there's no resistance. There's no slowing down. And what is so baffling about that is that if you were a spaceship and you entered it, you would become, in essence, God consciousness. You would know all events before and after they happen.
Now, what do you mean by entered it? Captured it?
You have to become single to enter it. And I think when Jesus said, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light, Buddha actually, in Buddhism, what you actually do is you cancel out duality, positive and negative thoughts, pleasure and pain. You actually try to overcome all the pairs of opposites, which is what in the great Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, you do the same thing. A yogi has to overcome all the different pairs of opposites, hot and cold, positive and negative thoughts.
Good and evil,
good,
right?
Good and evil, all of it. You're going to this single place. Jesus said in the Gospel of Thomas that if you make the above like the below, the male female and the female male, the inside like the outside, and he keeps going through this list of pairs of opposites, and when you make them all one, he said, you will tell the mountain to move and it will move.
See, how could someone like Einstein have thought about any of this, which he did not?
He did not.
Because he was such a scientist, he didn't understand the spirituality part of it, did he?
You almost need the spirituality part of it to go where Dirac went, and you have to wonder why this paper was rejected. Because what Dirac says in the next paragraph in the paper is that, oh my God, if you enter this place, you will be everywhere in the universe at the same time. And firstly, he noted, it solves one of the greatest problems astronomers are having right now, which is, according to the Big Bang Theory, the universe started with an enormous temperature explosion.
All right, hold that thought, David. Let's get that when we come right back. The Big Bang Theory on Coast to Coast AM. Well, our guest, of course, is David Sirota, and we'll be back with David in a moment. We're going to talk about the Big Bang Theory right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with David Sirota. Deep subject, David, that I think you're making it a little easier for us to understand.
Yeah.
The Big Bang Theory. Tell me your views on that.
Well, you got to consider, before we go to the Big Bang, what's known as the cosmic microwave background radiation viewed by astronomers and radio astronomers right now pervades the entire creation with a fairly constant temperature. I mean, it fluctuates a little bit. But according to the Big Bang Theory, the universe started at a sub-Planck length sphere, which is so small we can't even imagine, and exploded into this enormity of mass, which initially had a huge temperature and energy signal, which eventually, over time, the birth of time, cools down. So according to the Big Bang Theory, the background radiation should be a variation from hot to cold, from the point of origin of the Big Bang to the gradual expansion and cooling of the universe. But instead, it's even temperature everywhere. So this problem has not been solved by the current theory of relativity. However, Dirac's theory on singularity, that this substratum of singularity permeates the entire universe, and that matter, in these, what he has seen in these quantum models of from really high-frequency gamma waves, dual-paired electron-anti-electrons are born, and eventually protons are born, and antiprotons are born, and so forth, that actually what is happening is that because it's everywhere in zero time, it can allow for the temperature to be constant rather than a gradient everywhere in the universe, because this background kind of like oven kind of layer to the universe is instantaneous. And it happened instantaneously, but it was when duality, which is a pairedness, which is a wave, if you really look at, for example, a galaxy is a bunch of particles spinning through a spiraling waveform. Our solar system revolves around our galactic core in one orbit every 250 million years. So that's what's known as a really long wavelength, an extremely long wavelength, because we won't see a period or a frequency of one in our galactic waveform for 250 million years. But the galaxy, the universe itself, is an even longer wave. Longer waves are where most of the mass in a waveform exists. Probably why the background of space, dark matter, probably has 85 to 90% of all the mass in the universe. According to the Big Bang Theory, at the current rate of expansion of our universe, roughly 85% of the mass is missing. We can't see it. We don't know where it is. It's probably in that, literally, in the background of space where Einstein initially thought there wasn't any. So what's really happening with Dirac's theory, he actually is able to answer that, but he's also able to answer the birth of time, of the slowing down, because we go from this single place where everything is one, and when you enter it, the baffling thing about it, if you were to actually become single, which is beyond all pairedness, and enter this single state, you would literally be everywhere at once. And
are you still there, David?
Yeah.
Okay, I heard a little bit. Oh, you must have just hit your phone.
The desire to travel would take you a long time because you're virtually in all points of time at the same time, at the same moment. You're in all places at the same moment. So I think if you entered this place, you'd be so baffled you could hardly even move. You wouldn't even know where to go.
But do you actually believe, though, David, that a small particle was so compressed that it then blew up and has created all this physical mass in the universe that we see today? I just have a hard time understanding that.
Well, see, from the single place, that never happened, because from the single place, the physical universe is just an illusion of what we call time. But when you enter duality, everything slows down and time is born, you see?
Mm-hmm.
And when time is born, it looks like there was a Big Bang. But from the place of singularity, it never happened because all events have actually already happened. And it was the physicist Richard Feynman, who did experiments, for example, when he sent the electron, again, the lowest mass particle we know of, through the two slits in the cardboard. He found the electron went through both slits at the same time. And then if you put three slits, you'd find the same electron, not two different electrons, the same electron at the same time goes through all three slits. So each slit is almost like a choice in creation or a decision to create the slit, for one. And second, why does the same electron appear in all slits at the same time? Because what Feynman realized in his theoretical summary, what he calls the sum over histories, is if you make the choice, all histories exist at the same moment in time. But he didn't go much further than that. He remained truly baffled by that experiment, and no physicist could answer why that was. But singularity, when you really get frustrated with inertia, with time being so slow, with movement through our universe being so slow, and you see how elegant singularity is, and that you can prove that it actually exists, like Paul Dirac did, it answers everything. There really is no Big Bang. The universe only appears to have been banging or moving through this waveform over time, which is a birth.
Then that means that there must be other universes.
There must be other universes, and there must be more subtle layers or dimensions to singularity. You couldn't suddenly enter it in its totality. It would be too baffling. For example, well, I was in India where the Buddha attained enlightenment, and I went and meditated under the tree. And the monks there say that before he attained the enlightenment, the full enlightenment, he approached the tree and he stood on this one place. And they actually have these two footprints in stone, kind of embedded in the marble, where allegedly he stood. Some monks say 3 days and nights. Some monks say 3 months, and some say 3 years. I don't know a single human being, even if it's the lesser of the three, who could stand in one spot day and night for 3 days. But truly, he was baffled. He entered this state of oneness where you become so one with everything in this singularity that you are everywhere in the universe and you are all-knowing. There's no desire to move because you're already there in consciousness. But to be able to do it physically, to actually take form and volume, and move anywhere throughout any system in the universe, that, to me, is ultimate freedom. You're no longer a prisoner to time. You can see all events and move through all systems and transcend this duality that really just gives birth to chaos. Even in the Gospel of Philip, which was found in the Nag Hammadi Library collection in 1945 in Egypt, Jesus says, in this world there is good and evil. It's good things are not good, and it's evil things not evil. When theologists read that, they thought, oh my God, he's saying that evil isn't even evil. We have to get rid of this. But what he was really saying is to cancel out the pairs of opposites, because that is nothing but conflict. If I believe in good and evil, and I believe egotistically my religion is better than the other person's, we'll eventually disagree, separate, and maybe even go to war. And that's what happened in the fall in the garden. Because we believed in good and evil, we created it. Now, if you end the conflict internally, there is no more good and evil. There's no more war. There's no more I'm right and you're wrong. And if you trust it deep enough, we actually enter this place of singularity in consciousness, and we get to experience.
But that'll never happen with the greed factor.
Oh, it won't happen. It'll happen for the individual. The individual has the realization, enters the paradise mind of singularity. For the masses to really get this, no, the masses want to fight holy wars. They want to, you know, bomb the United States because they think, you know, Islam is superior to all religions in the world. And not all Islamics are like that, but I know that any religion, even Christianity in its extremist form, tries to conquer the other, saying that it is superior, it is better than the other. And that, you know, all religions in the world are guilty of the same problem, because we believe egotistically we're right, we've interpreted all right, and the other guy's got it wrong. But what all the masters and the great teachers are really saying is that's all an illusion. That duality is the illusion, and then when you enter the single place, that doesn't exist for you anymore. There's peace in singularity. There is no war. And because your mind is single, we don't create this anymore. There's a famous, again in the Nag Hammadi Library, gospel called the Trimorphic Protonoia, which actually is more evidence to the fact that the Theologians got it wrong, I hate to say. They inadvertently believed it was good that we knew good and evil, which if you really read Genesis correctly, that means you're taking the side of the devil because God warned us never take in the knowledge of good and evil. But in the trimorphic proto-noia, it actually says, for as our tree from which we grew, a fruit of ignorance is what it was. And it also has leaves, and it is death that dwells in them, and darkness dwells under the shadow of its boughs. And it was in deceit and lust that we harvested it, this tree through which ignorant chaos became our dwelling place. So chaos is duality, is good and evil, which is what we're trying to transcend. So what's so exciting about Dirac's rejected paper that I'm kind of bringing back to light, you know, thanks to my friend Luke Gatto, who introduced me to it, that, and Donald Hodson, who did all the work on actually preserving Dirac's work and bringing this forth. We now have proof in physics that the place of singularity exists and that we can all move towards that. And ultimately, the ultimate theory in physics is that we could actually transform spaceships or consciousness and enter this place and move anywhere in our universe instantaneously.
Okay, but how do we do this? Do we need machinery to do it?
I think initially it's through prayer and meditation. I mean, I've been meditating every day for 22 years now.
Now hold on there. You're saying through prayer and meditation we can move spacecraft throughout the universe?
No. Through prayer and meditation you can experience singularity, the place of singleness, which I have glimpsed through.
Well, yeah, I believe that. And I believe the Tibetans have done that. The Buddhists have done that.
But spaceships is another thing. If we look at, I mean, first we have the example of Christ resurrecting mass and turning into light, the resurrection. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's something called the rainbow body, where when a master dies, they say, don't touch the body for 7 days. And that particular master's body, there'll be a rainbow around the body. And all of a sudden, the body's gone, but the hair is remaining. The scalp is remaining, which is kind of like a joke that the master leaves behind, that I've actually transformed my flesh. There are no bones. There's no more flesh, and it's all light now. And some of those students of that teacher will see that master appear and move around. In Autobiography of a Yogi, written by the story of Paramahansa Yogananda, there are stories of masters moving in their bodies of light. In India, they would see what appeared to be shooting stars, and they'd land on the earth, materializes into the form of their teacher. And in India, they've seen Jesus Christ even in the Himalayas with some of their greatest masters hanging out together and then giving a teaching and turning back into light and shooting off into space. Well, that's essentially our potential, that we can all actually do this. But the teachings have been hidden deeply in these manuscripts for thousands of years. For example, the Nag Hammadi Library for Christianity. And even the Catholic Church has called it a heresy because they didn't believe that the people should have access to this higher knowledge, because by it they could become free and they wouldn't have to be subjects to the Church. In essence, a slavery relationship. You would become totally free. You can move anywhere throughout any system just like Jesus did, and just like, you know, many of the great other masters from other religions have done. So I think that's what's so exciting about Dirac's paper, is it proves it in a physics form, and eventually when we can master this, when we can actually find singularity in a physics model, we will be able to build spaceships that will at least be able to go multiples, many multiples of the speed of light and start visiting other star systems. It's almost like, you know, we're sitting here on this planet, there's nothing anywhere near us right now that we can see other life forms, not in the other, you know, 8 or 9 planets that we have in our solar system, that we have to attain this beyond light speed to visit anybody else in the creation. And it's like a code. You have to decode it, the matrix, to find out how to do this.
Well, I was going to say, do you think this code has been decoded by super advanced extraterrestrials?
I do, and that's what I think only the angelic, only the enlightened extraterrestrials have figured out singularity. I don't believe that an unevolved or violent species, I don't believe any species, for one, that enters singularity could be violent in the first place, because in singularity there's no conflict.
So you don't think they invented, David, or they found, let's say, wormholes to bend space and time and travel that way?
No, wormholes. A wormhole requires the negative energy of 100 million suns, according to Kip Thorne at Caltech. That's every sun in our galaxy. There are approximately 100,000 suns in our galaxy alone, the Milky Way galaxy. That's all the negative energy they put out for an entire solar year to make one wormhole wide enough to fit a quarter through. Now, if you're going to make a spaceship go through it, you have to widen the snout, and that means it requires even more energy than that. No, they're not doing it this way. But if you reduce the mass gravity effect of 2 points in space-time, it doesn't take anywhere near that much energy. That's what these guys haven't got yet, that's how they're doing it. To move mass in its current form, as Einstein's law shows, it takes too much energy because of the increased mass law and inertia. But if you transform mass first, which is what the masters were teaching us by the resurrection, then you can do it instantaneously with tiny amounts of energy. And I think now all the emphasis will be on transformation. I've actually been approached in my lectures at you know, the UFO conferences by NASA scientists and other scientists who have approached me and formally asked me to submit my paper on my theoretical work, which is now published at AmericanAntiGravity.com. I mean, the people can read this in great detail how this is actually happening. There is an interest at NASA. I mean, one conference I spoke at this winter, Stephen Bassett's conference in Washington.
The X conference.
The X conference. I'm in the audience sitting next to a gentleman, and, you know, we're talking, and we're in the front row watching Jaime Musson's lecture. This guy's a U.S. Army physicist, and I said, what are you doing here? And he said, I'm curious. These guys, they don't – it's only the press, the media, the mainstream media that laughs at this stuff. You know, if you go to these conferences, you will see – I mean, you'll see everything at a UFO conference. You'll see retired people who are just exploring their minds because they're not working anymore. You'll see people who seem a little bit fringe. You'll see New Age people, healers. Everybody is there. And then you'll see an Army physicist or someone from NASA who's exploring the UFO phenomena.
David, I want to take the next half hour to talk with you about time travel.
Okay.
If we can, whether you think it's possible, whether you think we can only go in the future or back in the past, and also to ask you that big question of whether you think time travelers from the future have actually come back here. But you had mentioned earlier on about the energy in the universe that Einstein didn't believe, but he did 10 years later. Are you familiar with the work of the late William Reich, by any chance?
Yeah, Wilhelm Reich. Yeah, I'm not. I haven't read his work, but I'm familiar with him.
He believed in this orgone, this substance in the universe that you could tap into for energy and all kinds of things, very similar to some of the things you've been talking about.
I mean, where we are right now in the universe, I mean, we need energy to move. We're not so advanced that we're able to do the kind of things I'm talking about right now. Theory ultimately leads to better technology and better telecommunication systems. And, you know, thanks to Einstein and Tesla and many, you know, Thomas Edison, all of them, we now have telephones and we can speak to millions of people at the same time. We have television. We can send information, pictures, you know, through photons and reassemble it in TV sets. It's really fantastic how far we've come. But to go where I'm talking about is really the theoretical work is just being laid now. Right now we need energy. We need a new energy source right now. We need zero-point energy to get past this point of self-destruction. And I think at a base level, we can start to use more solar and wind power to kind of, you know, reduce global warming on a global scale and energy-saving light bulbs and even bicycles where we can. but to make these leaps, it's really about us. We have to start investigating all of these scientists. You know, Wilhelm Reich, Trevor James Constable, who's a friend of mine. There are many great thinkers in America today. They're just not getting enough focus and attention from our institutions.
We're going to talk about time travel when we come right back. With our guest, David Sirita, we'll be back with David in a moment. Time travel's next on the agenda. Maybe he knows a little bit about John Titor. We'll be right back. David, time travel. First of all, do you think it's possible, whether we go back or forward?
Absolutely possible, yeah.
Okay. What do we need to do it?
Well, firstly, you know, imagine yourself in singularity, which is everywhere in all of space-time in zero time. So from that perspective, all events have, like Richard Feynman said in the Sum Over Histories, all events, every possible event has already happened. I'm reminded in the movie The Matrix when Neo actually gets to meet the Creator, and the Creator tells him, "You're not here to, you're here to find out why you made the choices you did. You can't change them because they've already happened in time." And it's actually a pretty brilliant presentation of that in the movie The Matrix. So that, from our perspective right now, when you imagine duality being born, when positive and negative forces encounter each other, they pressure against each other and they slow energy down, and time is actually born. So time in itself is a dual-paired waveform. For example, we're standing at a point on our planet, every one of us. The planet, if you follow the path of the rotation of the planet around, it's producing wave particle streams. If you follow the point and you move through time rotating around the planet, that's actually a rotational wave, and then that planet is revolving around the sun. Our planet rotates once every 24 hours. The planet revolves around the sun once a year, and the solar system revolves around the galactic core once every 250 million years. So that's kind of how we experience time. Time is also a waveform. Einstein said that as we accelerate, if a viewer were to accelerate towards the speed of light, time would slow down for them towards zero when you reach the ultimate velocity, what appears to be zero. Really, we're just heading towards an infinite zero point. Now, if you also go the other way and you slow down to absolute zero velocity, you also reach another type of zero point, which is where time actually takes forever to go anywhere, so you also go into this same kind of eternal point on both ends of the spectrum. Now, if we're actually seeing the birth of time in a waveform, we understand that we perceive time, and our brain is actually producing brain waves. This is actually a great analogy. When the brain is active in the middle of the day, it peaks at about 100 waves per second. It oscillates normally roughly around 30 waves per second. And as we go to sleep, the brain slows down. It starts, if you're a really deep meditator or sleeper, you can get down to 0.5 waves per second, which are amazingly low epsilon waves. So you go through the alpha, you know, beta, delta, and theta states where the brain is slowing down. Now what happens is as the brain slows down, huge quantities of time go by like that, sure, instantaneously. And when you're in peak physical activity, for example, if you're skiing or if you're skydiving, really extreme, which I've done, a second is like an eternity from a perception point of view. So when frequency increases for the observer, time slows down, just like it does with velocity. When waveforms slow down in frequency, huge quantities of time go by very quickly. So it all has to do with quantity or quanta, packets of time, which is a perception. So from the point of singularity, there is no time, because from that perspective, like Jesus said, I am the Alpha and the Omega. He's the beginning and end of all events, because that consciousness itself, which we call God, is everywhere in space-time all the time anyway. So there, it knows the beginning and end of all events.
If we were able to travel back into time, do you believe that people would actually be able to witness past events, or is that wishful thinking?
No, I think you could actually witness past events, but also future events. I mean, this is something amazing that happened to me personally. My girlfriend, myself, and my brother woke up in San Francisco on August 20th, and we all had a dream that was the same. My brother dreamt that he saw a city in absolute ruins, and he said it looked like the aftermath of a nuclear bomb. I mean, buildings were just flattened everywhere. I dreamt that I was crawling through the rubble and debris of buildings that I could actually see traces of chemical or radioactive or chemical pollution. And my girlfriend dreamt that people were being warned to evacuate this city, and they weren't listening. And that was before this hurricane even formed itself. And then, of course, when the hurricane happened, it was like, oh, my God, that was our dream. But why did we all three dream it the same night before it happened? Because in theory, and Richard Feynman proved it, all events have actually already happened. It's time that hasn't unveiled it yet. So what happens to the brain is, in these deep states of sleep, when it slows down, huge quantities of time accelerate. So therefore, you can move forward and backward on this timeline, and you can experience prophecy. Anybody can experience prophecy. But to experience it incredibly accurately, to know the exact place and the exact time of an event, is much more difficult. I mean, I certainly am not a prophet, but I did find that coincidental. And this happens to many, many people where they see an event. Now, however, if we change our course in time, those, and that's just like the two slits in Feynman's cardboard. If you make a different choice, you will, the same electron will experience a different reality. So you no longer go down that certain path. So the future event exists, according to Feynman, but you won't experience it because you made a different choice. The same person, or example, electron, will experience a different reality, but it will, theoretically, if you can make two choices at the same time, you become split. You will experience both at the same time. I think that's partially what happened to physicist John Nash. It was an experience where he was experiencing parallel universes or different histories or possibilities for what happened on Earth. John Nash said in an interview with Quadrant Magazine and also in the book, Beautiful Mind, that he was receiving messages from extraterrestrials. If we go back to Pythagoras, another great mathematician, There's a story in Pythagoras' A Life where Pythagoras actually grows up with an extraterrestrial named Astraeus, who becomes one of his teachers. And Astraeus had all these magical powers. He was human. He actually was his stepbrother. His father found him sitting under a tree one day, sipping on moisture from blades of grass, and noticed that he didn't look like all other human beings, and that he was staring at the sun without blinking, and that he had possessed all these magical powers. And even Pythagoras philosophized way back, you know, the early Greek philosopher, that you could transform the mass of your body and turn it into light and move throughout our solar system and communicate with other beings of light. I mean, this is really what appears to be primitive stuff, but really he's talking about the same physics I am, mm-hmm. but in a much more basic, generic way. He doesn't actually go into waveform models to explain how that's possible, but he does get, you know, very evolved in his acceptance of extraterrestrials. I mean, that's Pythagoras, two great mathematicians who said they were in contact with extraterrestrials. Now, for time, for what are known as time dilations, let's look at Roswell, because this is a fun one for me, and this is my theory on Roswell.
Okay, 1947.
1947, July 5th through the 9th. The dates are really hard to get on Roswell, but let's go back 2 years earlier. Same dates, Trinity. The first nuclear bomb ever detonated is at Trinity site in New Mexico. Original date I got was July 5th, 1945, but some say the 13th, the 9th. Again, you get different dates on Trinity. But roughly the same date, but 2 years later, you got two UFO crashes on either side of Trinity. You've got Roswell down to the southeast, and you've got the plane of St. Augustine UFO crash up on the upper part
true.
Of the state.
Okay.
Now, imagine, in my theory, these UFOs are vibrating in ultra-high-frequency wavelengths, probably way up in the gamma spectrum, which are the highest wavelengths we know of. And for them, time has actually slowed down because they, from their perception, they're in a higher-frequency domain. And their physical craft, their actual craft, are all in that domain as well. So for them, time has slowed down. They're watching these humans putting together this device, and they're hovering around us, and we detonate a nuclear weapon, which I don't think they really understood what we were doing. And the intense gamma radiation from that detonation, you get 200 million electron volt gammas in a nuclear bomb explosion using plutonium. that intense burst of gamma radiation, because it's their same wavelength, would knock them out, distort their craft intensely because they're so close to it. And those craft would get thrown out onto either side of Trinity, one towards Roswell and the other ones down up in the plain of St. Augustine. And we wouldn't see the effects until 2 years later on the same dates because of time dilation, because it took time for their craft to be in the distortion of the gamma waves to slow down in frequency and enter our domain and crash. I cannot accept the fact that a UFO would crash, or you can go from one star system to another, but you can't seem to navigate around a simple little planet. And you
let crash. Let alone two.
Let alone two on either side of the Trinity site. Now, if that is indeed what happened at Roswell, it shows an example of time dilation, and which is Einstein, which is that as you approach the speed of light, time slows down, and also if you increase in frequency, time also slows down. You won't see the effects until 2 years, or in that case, it was 2 years later, approximately the same dates on either side of Trinity. I don't think that's a coincidence. If you also look at the Battle of 42 UFO over the city of Los Angeles in 1942, we fired 1,400 rounds of munitions at that thing. It was up there for 5 hours. None of the munitions touched it because in its state of high frequency, which means it has no mass, the munitions go right through it. They don't interact with it. The only thing that will affect it in a negative way will be something at its same wavelength.
Right.
So if it's vibrating in the visible light spectrum, you need an intense burst of microwave radiation or something to distort it. That is their weakness, that something at their wavelength could actually harm them. So if UFOs were going to harm us, we can't fire munitions at them when they're in this high frequency state. Only when they're in a much more low frequency state where their mass goes much lower and they become more physical can we fire munitions at them. So that's kind of an example of what we call time dilation in the UFO phenomenon. So can we move through time? The same thing becomes possible when we can manipulate. For example, go to the Tesla experiment on the Philadelphia experiment. If they change the frequency of mass and the military officers on the vessel with the Tesla coil, then in essence you could experience a time dilation where you can move forward or backward in time. To have control of that requires amazing mastery. You have to have incredible knowledge of waveforms and their precise movements and precise frequencies at different intervals of time to understand how to have control over that process. I think the Philadelphia experiment was interesting. It was an accident, in essence. They tried to do something, but they didn't have total control over it.
Were you aware? Have you ever heard of the name John Teeter, David?
No, I am not.
Okay, he is someone who several years ago started posting on the internet, and a lot of people believe that he was indeed a time traveler. He said some uncanny things, a few of which are beginning to come true about the future, but he was from the year 2036. Now, you know, regardless of whether Teeter was real or not, here's the question. Do you think it's possible
that if
time travel exists, and you already believe that, that someone from the future, albeit 2036, 2050, who knows when, might be coming back around this period? And so some people who say that they are time travelers, of which a few years ago I would have thought they were nuts and needed to be locked up, might indeed be time travelers.
Oh, absolutely. From the perspective of singularity, you have access to all events forward and backward in time. They're actually an illusion because they're created. Time is created by inertia, which is created by duality, which is the proverbial fall from the Garden of Eden. So from singularity, if you can reach singularity, any point in time is accessible, any point. So really, you kind of see. I mean, it's so frustrating. It's almost like when you see that light cannot tell you what is happening in the universe in real time, in interstellar and intergalactic events, it's kind of frustrating. It's like, where is the force that is beyond space-time? What can communicate in real time? If we go back to the Secret Life of Plants, there is a book called The Secret Life of Plants that was published in the 70s, and Clive Baxter hooked up a EEG, which is the brain mapping technology.
Christopher Bird, right?
Yeah, and to plants to find out if they were intelligent, and they found out indeed they were. Well, in the documentary, The Secret Life of Plants, which I actually saw, a friend of mine named Mylise from England is actually trying to continue Clive Baxter's work and advance the science of plant communication. She showed me a copy of the movie that was never actually released. There's an astronomer who hooked up a telescope and pointed it to the star system of Sirius, and he's actually a very well-known astronomer today. He attached a Faraday cage around the telescope to block out all interfering electromagnetic radiation. He put living sprouted mustard seeds at the collection array, you know, where the light comes through the telescope, where from that star focuses on the mustard seeds, and he hooks the mustard seeds up to an EEG, and he seems to be getting what appears to be an intelligent signal coming from Sirius. But that's
through the mustard
radio astronomers
seeds?
Can't do that. So what we discover later is that there's something called biophotons, that living photons from plants could possibly be communicating in real time because they're living photons versus looking at what is right now, we're looking at radio waves, which are essentially dead. There's no consciousness attached to a radio photon. But there's consciousness attached to a plant's biophoton energy. So could it be that living photons are able to tap into these wavelengths where they can actually experience the star system of Sirius in real time, and that we could actually go there? When I actually looked his name up on the Internet, I don't have his name right now because I wasn't expecting to go into this tonight, but I found out he's today a major astronomer. But why wasn't SETI aware of this? Why wasn't this the biggest discovery?
Well, that's a great story.
It's a great story. So we almost need to reactivate these experiments and re-experiment with them and find out if it's true. I mean, can biophotons, and if you look up biophotons on Google, you'll find tons of articles. This is a new area of research. But could living photons, you know what's going on in our universe in real time? I mean, that's so important to know what's going on in the universe in real time, and that the photons we're looking at through telescopes are not telling us the truth about what's happening right now. And maybe biophotons are actually getting close to singularity, and that's why they can do it.
Yeah, but you believe, though, that time travelers could be here from the future.
Oh, absolutely, because when you understand the physics of everything from my perspective, oh, absolutely, it's possible. Do I know how to do it? I think I know how to build and design wave generators and Tesla coils that would be far more advanced of what we're using today to transmit radio waves.
David's website, of course, is UFONASA.com, UFONASA.com, linked at coasttocoastam.com. David, you have a toll-free number for books
also,
and tapes?
No, my other website is davidserita.blogspot.com.
Spell your name for us. Spell your name.
It's David, S-E-R-E-D-A, .blogspot.com. That's where all of my information and all my links are. You can find
okay,
them.
And I think that's linked up at coasttocoastam.com
yeah.
as well. And you have a toll-free number?
I think where Evidence the Case for NASA UFOs is being sold is Terror Entertainment, and I think it's just 1-877-UFO-NASA. People can call tomorrow.
All right, stay with us.
They haven't seen that film yet. I'm working on new films right now.
All right, we'll be back. We'll take phone calls next hour for the entire hour. With our guest, David Serita, on Coast to Coast AM, I'm George Norrie. And now it's your turn, your phone calls with our special guest, David Serita. Lots to talk about, the universe, time travel, spirituality, you name it. We've got it right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, David Serita, our guest, and your phone calls as well. David, I like the tie-in, by the way, with Genesis. But let me ask you a question just about Jesus here. this has always fascinated me. You were referencing Krishna as well. Mm-hmm. Might the individual be one of the same?
It's really amazing, because if you think, again, of what singularity is, and that any person who attains singularity enlightenment is in a unified field with it, and there is no separation, is it possible that every great cycle that humanity goes through, God in the highest, takes human form? I mean, could it have been that Krishna was just an embodiment of that same consciousness that Christ is, that Buddha is different. Buddha is a man who attained enlightenment. Christ and Krishna are beings that were said to be what is known as an avatar, is a being who was born that way. They don't attain it. They've always been that. And possibly Osiris back in the times of Egypt. I don't really know the answer to that. It's a really difficult question, and I have pondered it, and I've gone, you know, into some pretty powerful evidence. The only difference with Krishna is that it is described in the Gita that no matter how many times, thousands of times brighter than the sun he was when he appeared after the great battle of Kurukshetra, that you could actually gaze upon him. The difference between the Ancient of Days who appears to the first prophet in the Bible, Enoch, and who appeared to Moses, and that Jesus, when he transfigured on the mount, that it was so powerful you could not look. And if you consider that the creator of the universe, the force of that creation, contains so much energy that there's no way a human being could bear to look at it in its entirety. It would devastate them. It seems more accurate that you couldn't look, that you couldn't survive a direct gaze unless God lowers God's vibration to make it possible for the human to merely survive a fractionary gaze. I mean, Enoch, when he sees God, he falls flat on his face, just like the disciples did when Jesus transfigured on the mountain. They could not stand up. They could not look at him. There are many examples of transfigurations in the extra-biblical Gospels where the disciples were begging him to stop and return to normal because the ecstasy in the Holy Spirit was too powerful for them to bear. But there are no descriptions of that in Krishna's story. There is this great light upon him that is enormous for a human being to look at, but it's not described at that magnitude. So just based on that, and I can't say I know for certain the answer, I would say that there is a difference.
All right, let's go to the phones. You ready? We'll pick it up by going to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with David Sarita. Hi there.
Hey, good morning. My name is Chuck. I'm calling from Virginia right now.
Hi, Chuck. Thank you.
And I just had two quick questions. I'll listen off the air. Our first question, as far as space travel, they say the shortest distance between two points is probably like A to B, a straight line.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the folding of that space to have A and B in the middle? And the other question would be, we know humans have been on the planet for like tens of thousands of years. It seemed like in the last 100 or so years, like the technology has been splurged on us. Do you think that has been like an influence of alien or, say, time travelers who give us this technology? And I'm thinking that we now should be like more advanced than what we are now. And I listen off the air if you understand those questions.
Well, that's a great question. Actually, the second question, I mean,
go ahead. I guess he's listening.
Yeah, I mean, as far as folding space and time, I mean, that's essentially the Einstein-Rosen bridges and wormholes. And you can clearly see it takes too much energy to do that unless you reduce the mass gravity effect of the two points that you're folding. Otherwise, it's just impossible. No civilization could harness the negative energy of 100 million suns for an entire year. That's just not possible. But the other way it is. The second question, I mean, again, go back to the mathematician Pythagoras. In the book Pythagoras, A Life, there are very clear, distinct descriptions of, and this is not a channeled book. This is a very scholarly, you know, printed book in England at a very high university level that Pythagoras actually grew up with Astraeus, an actual extraterrestrial who taught him higher math and higher learning, that he learned from these star beings as they were described. And we go to John Nash, who was called schizophrenic, but you got to wonder about a guy who solved every math problem of his day. He was not incapable of doing his work, and yet he said he was in contact with extraterrestrials. So as far as how extraterrestrials communicate with us, I believe we have evidence in two cases of two great mathematicians that were communicating with extraterrestrials, and what they learned from them eventually translates into technology. It's possible Einstein and Tesla were, but didn't want to speak about it because they didn't want to be ridiculed. Maybe that's one way it happens. The other way it could happen is just through very non-intrusive presence of extraterrestrials that teach us in this kind of fashion. And I've actually had experiences like that, and that's where I have learned a lot of my physics from these same type of beings. So that answers this question. I hope it does.
All right, next up, east of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, hi, this is Scott from Virginia, and hi, David, and hi, George. I have a quick question. Have you heard of the concept of Kundalini energy, and have you heard of Gopi Krishna, and how does it – well, let me just ask you that first.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've heard of Kundalini energy, and I've experienced it from practicing meditation for 25 years now. I've had many experiences with it. And that is a transformational energy that we can awaken inside of ourselves.
Yeah, well, Gopi Krishna activated it at the age of 34 after 17 years of intensive meditation, mm-hmm. like yourself. And he reported that he felt a stream of liquid light enter his brain through the spinal cord, which caused an immediate expansion of his consciousness,
mm-hmm.
kind of like his consciousness expanded in waves of light.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon his observing consciousness became the universe, and then even more than that, and he lived in this state for 40 years, and he wrote 16 books on this. And basically the theory is that it activates a dormant chamber in the brain,
mm-hmm.
and that our brain is in a state of evolution. Have you heard of any of this before?
Oh, absolutely. I've heard of all of it. I've met so many different gurus from India. I could name tens of them. I've traveled to India, and I've studied with them, and I've had experiences with masters that are not of this earth anymore. But those are all great teachers. I mean, if you really practice these techniques and you do it faithfully, you will have the experience they are having. But in consciousness, what I'm interested in are the very rare cases where a master can not only experience singularity as consciousness, but they can actually take mass or their body with them and ultimately lead to spaceships and technology that where we can actually move around without destroying our planet. We can actually propel ourselves in air vehicles and motor vehicles that are no longer destroying the planet. I mean, it's one thing to attain consciousness, and if you get really advanced in Buddhism, for example, Buddha says in the Lankavatara 8 Sutra, for those who care to look it up, that there are 7 levels of enlightenment, that nirvana doesn't happen until the 7th level, and you can't attain it. The samadhis or states of enlightenment 1 through 6 are impermanent. You can visit them, enjoy them. They're extremely evolved. But you will not attain supreme enlightenment until you do something for humanity. Because enlightenment by its nature is a unified field for all. You're not becoming enlightened to save yourself. You're becoming enlightened to save yourself and humanity. So the disciple has to become so devoted and so in love with humanity that they want to do something to raise it, to bring it to a higher level, whether that's helping the poor like the Mother Teresa did, or feeding the homeless, or working for the Red Cross, or building new technology that will transform our planet. That's where all of this stuff goes. In order for us to go to these higher level of consciousness, we have to engage. We can't just sit there and voice out with this light. Although that is a great experience, I've experienced it many times. I'm more involved now in trying to waken people up to the idea of sustainable energy technologies and, you know, getting on to reducing global warming and transforming our global ecology, because that's what I feel motivated to do right now.
David, I'm getting a lot of fast blasts and emails. People want to know about that 60-page report that's available.
It's at AmericanAntiGravity.com. If you go to the breaking news section on the right, you'll see my paper, David Sarita's Advanced Propulsion Document. It's a PDF file, and you can download it right there. It's 60 pages, and I've made it so that anyone can understand it. I mean, you don't have to. There's no math formulas in it. It's diagrams and writing in order to understand how, you know, how I'm able to do this reaching singularity and also breaking the speed of light.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on with David Sarita. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah.
This is Steve in Lower Lake, California, about 150 miles north of San Francisco.
Okay, sir. Thank you.
Great show, great guest. I have a couple of questions that I would like to present to David, and I would like to hear your input, too, if you care to give
it. Okay, sure thing.
Number one, David, considering that the singularity, within the singularity, all time exists simultaneously, past and future, how does that jibe with the concept of free will?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question. I mean, free will, it's kind of an irony. When we say free will, you remember, if you go back to the proverbial fall in the Garden of Eden, that when we partook of the knowledge of good and evil, we wanted to decide for ourselves, egotistically, what is right and what is wrong, what to do. And that we separated ourselves from singularity, where we are in this unified field state of consciousness and reality that is all pervading in our universe. So in essence, we became individual egos and separated from that. So we do have free will. But because of free will, everyone's will, sometimes we form groups or congregations or corporations or religions that generally agree, although we have infighting or disagreements inside of the corporation or the religion. We generally agree, but we'll always be opposed to another corporation or in competition with another corporation or other religion. So free will, the way I see it from duality, ultimately is suffused with conflict, with duality. That true freedom and true free will is in singularity. That's where you're really free from conflict, and you enter a higher state of freedom or liberation.
Fantastic. Thank you. Second point. I think that you would agree with me that we must assume that this singularity has always existed. It had no beginning.
It had no beginning and no end.
Therefore, David, all things that are possible have not only already happened, but they've already happened an infinite number of times.
Absolutely. That's what Richard Feynman discovered. I mean, it was a revelation for him when he did that simple little experiment. Every event, every possibility has already happened. It's up to us to discover it and then choose it.
So final question, why is it still happening since it's already happened an infinite number of times?
Well, see, because from our perspective in time, it hasn't happened yet. But in singularity, the Alpha and the Omega are one. They've all already happened.
But if you have eternity, then you have plenty of time for everything to have already happened an infinite number of times.
Well, because, again, when you go towards, again, the very slow or long wavelengths, time accelerates, but it accelerates towards infinity. When you go to higher frequency wavelengths, you're hitting another zero point, which is where time slows down to almost towards an infinite zero point. So on both ends of the spectrum, the high frequency perception of time and the low frequency perception, they both go towards infinite zero points. So they are infinities on both ends.
Could you say that singularity is God, David?
That to me, this theory in physics, that's actually the most exciting thing about it to me, is it when you follow the words of the mystics, when Jesus said, when you make the two one, and that I am from the single place, and when you're in the single place, tell the mountain to move and it will move, it really proves the existence of God. I mean, to me, that's what's so exciting about singularity in physics, is it finally, physics doesn't only prove spirituality, because already quantum physicists could see what Buddhism discovered, that is that all things are impermanent. You know, subatomic particles have what are known as half-lives, half of the state of that they're in decays in this particular period known as a half-life, and it just keeps decaying, and transforming and changing. In Buddhism, that's called anicca. Everything is changing. The only thing that is a constant in physics is light. As we know it, it doesn't seem to stop, but it does undergo reactions when it interacts with the photoelectric effect, which is when photons interact with mass. So they go through another change there. So ultimately, the only thing that's constant is light. Everything else is changing. In Buddhism, it's called anicca. So Buddhism already proved that. But singularity is something that I think all of the great masters were pointing to. And I think because we're finding it in physics, it does prove the existence of God. In the physics sense, if you were an atheist and you really looked at this properly, you would be convinced.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is John in Simi Valley.
All right, and that's in California, for those who might not know.
Thank you. This is one of my favorite guests that you've had. I wanted to ask David, by the way, I've seen the evidence video, and I think everybody should see that. It's a very good video.
Thank you.
My questions have to do with, you were mentioning Pythagoras, I read a book by a man by the name of Guy Murchie, Music of the Spheres. Mm-hmm. And in that book, he tends to pull together the microcosm and the macrocosm in terms of music, mm-hmm. and proportion. And so I was just curious, had you seen these properties of music or musicality in the physics research that you've done?
Well, music and sound. Actually, Pythagoras says one of the ways to transform consciousness or possibly even flesh into light is through sound or certain intonations. And if you look at sound, of course, it's also a waveform, and it has higher and lower frequency wavelengths. So it operates in the same way. And the way you experience time through sound is also operates in the same kind of physics that I'm talking about. But, you know, music is actually something my fiance and girlfriend's involved with. I love music, but I don't really understand it. I just enjoy it. It's just music is something, I mean, really, to me, music is one of the only vehicles for time travel that I know of. When I listen to a Beatles song, I'm there. I was born in 61, but I'm in the 60s and the 70s. I feel like I'm there. It's almost like that movie with, what was it called? Somewhere in Time. I don't know if you...
Somewhere in Time with Christopher Reeve.
With Christopher Reeve and what's the actress's name?
Jane Seymour.
If you concentrate hard enough, if the music takes you back and you really believe you're there, maybe you will move back in time and through music. I mean, it's an incredible possibility.
It's one of my favorite movies.
It is. Amazing.
And by the way, the music is fantastic.
It's really incredible.
In that movie as well. Thanks for that call. Appreciate it. David, just a few moments to go before break, then we'll come back with final phone calls for you. And Lex has links up on both of your websites. What's next on your plate in the next few months?
Well, right now I'm making a series of about 15 EcoPod films on solutions for the ecology. I'm finishing editing Dan Aykroyd Unplugged on UFOs for Arclight Studios. They're going to be releasing it virtually everywhere in early 2006.
Hey, why don't you get Dan on our show with you, and we'll do an hour in the not-too-distant future. You want to do that?
Yeah, I think he would probably enjoy that. I'll see where he's at.
Okay, I'll let you work on that with Lisa, if you would. And we'll be back in a moment with David Cerita on Coast to Coast AM. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, William Henry, that's right, investigative mythologist, will be our special guest as he talks about new Atlantis prophecies. So you don't want to miss that. We'll be back in a moment, though. More your phone calls with our guest David Cerita on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We'll go straight to your phone calls with our guest, David Cerita, because the clock is ticking. Talk about going back in the time, David. I bet sometimes we should do that because we always have more people on hold than we can get to.
Johnny Cash just took me there.
Isn't that something?
I just love Johnny Cash. I love him so much.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Is this me?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Great. Wow. Lot to get to. I'm going to have to take notes. I wanted to call in. I've never been able to get through before, so if I go long, I'll try to be quick, but I don't know when my next chance to get on is. Again, George, always good shows. Tonight, stupendous.
Thank you.
David, I think you're expanding a lot of minds out there. And you just, you're just blowing the lid off stuff. It's really amazing stuff. I'm really into it.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm loving it. I'm assuming a lot of other people. I'm in Lehigh Valley in Pennsylvania. I'm assuming a lot of other people are loving it out here as well. George, I have a couple of comments about the show, and then just one or two quick ones for David, and then I'm gone.
Okay.
George, let's see. Yeah, I got you on AM 790 out here,
mm-hmm.
which is a lot of Republican stuff. So it's kind of nice and refreshing to hear such open-minded free thinkers on your show. You know what I mean? I'm digging it. Anyway.
Well, you always will get an open mind program here.
Well, that's why I love about the show. I try to listen every night. But the paranormal investigators you had on the other night with the EVP.
That was Art's program.
I'm sorry.
Restrict this to David's call, okay?
Okay.
Because he's got so many people calling for him.
Like I said, I really did want to get a bunch of stuff in. Anyway, David, are you the Kwisatz Haderach?
What's that?
It's really weird. I was just starting to read Dune by Frank Herbert today.
Oh, right. I've read those a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, there's a lot of religious stuff in there, and the hero of the story is obtaining powers very similar to what you're talking about, mm-hmm. the shortening of the way, being in two places at once.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was interesting because you're kind of quoting a lot of... you know, actual religious text, and here you are kind of mirroring almost this this fictional text.
Well, actually, in Buddhism, the bodhisattvas are able to appear in thousands of places in the universe at the same time.
Wow.
And the Dalai Lama is an emanation of one of the eight great bodhisattvas, whom is called Avalokiteshvara, a supreme bodhisattva of compassion. And the reason they appear in so many places at the same time is only as they are needed, as people need to receive teachings, it will become first two places, bilocation, trilocation, quadrilocation, and then it goes all the way up. Yeah. And there's also examples of that with Christ in the Nag Hammadi library text. So that we know how that's answered in quantum physics models. Richard Feynman showed us how that's possible.
Again, that's one of the things I wanted to comment on. George, your guests always do their homework.
And they do. I'm
this
telling
guy's
you.
Not only no exception to that, but he's just blowing the lid off it. He's just going above and beyond. And like I said, it's really, really exciting stuff. I'm glad I got to hear it. And thanks for having me on.
Okay, I'm glad you got through finally after all these years. First time caller line. Your turn. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George.
Yes, sir. Hi.
Hi, David. Hi, George. My name is John. I'm from Tucson, Arizona.
Go ahead,
Tucson. John.
How you guys doing?
Good. I just drove through there the other day.
There you go. It's great to speak with you guys, and I just wanted to let you know. I've done some research with Mr. Stephen Hawking mm-hmm. and his advancement of Einstein's theory of relativity, and I just wanted to know, does that have anything to do with this? Does it play into the time travel and singularity?
Well, let's get that one first. Go, David.
Yeah, I don't think Einstein went into singularity. It's only Paul Dirac who won the Nobel Prize, and I think it's 1932-33. He shared it with Erwin Schrödinger, who did work on wave models. He is the one, and only in his rejected paper, who found this singularity thing. I'm bringing it to light and merging it with spiritual models to give it some body so that we can really, really realize that there is a genius discovery here thanks to Paul Dirac.
But it wasn't a very popular theory when he first came out with it.
No, because it was so beyond everything. And it's only those quantum models where he saw the dual pairs of electron anti-electrons going into higher frequency orbits and disappearing that led him to it, because he wanted to know where they went. Where did they go? We've never seen matter literally transform and disappear before on any scale in the physics world, and he's the only one to have taken note of it. He notes that other physicists misinterpreted what was happening. He said there's no way antimatter and matter came anywhere near each other. They just went into higher frequency orbits and they disappeared. They did not annihilate. They did not meet up. So that is the breakthrough. Paul Dirac.
Do you think SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, do you think they're wasting time and money doing what they're doing?
Yeah, I think they need to be more open-minded over there. I mean, I've tried to get into conversations with Seth Shostak, and I've talked to some of his staff, And they've admitted to me, there's no doubt. I mean, we can look at information inside of billion hertz waves right now, light waves. That's in the radio spectrum. The color red is in the quadrillion hertz spectrum, and that's even a very low frequency wavelength. So if you can't even look at information inside of visible light, we can see visible light, but we can't attach and extract information from it. And you consider an extraterrestrial civilization is going to be broadcasting most likely in the gamma spectrum when you consider wave distortion over great distances. Longer waves share information and they cross other waves as they travel through the universe. They distort. Remember in the old days, your cordless phone, you could hear your neighbor on your phone. That's because the longer wavelengths, lower frequency cordless phones would capture the waves of your neighbor because they crossed each other. That's distortion, but the higher frequency they get, the more pure they are. An extraterrestrial civilization is going to be, to me, is going to be sending information in gamma waves. So we're not even anywhere near that. But biophotons lend another possibility, that if we can actually look at information in biophotons, like what happened in the documentary, The Secret Life of Plants, I think SETI just needs to open their minds. They're just too closed-minded over there. They won't listen to this stuff. And I, you know, get on the phone, I get them to admit this, but they won't take it seriously. They're stuck. I think they just want to collect money and get paid and look at empty space and look at blank signals all day. It must be pretty boring over there, really.
Wild Card Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Good evening, George. This is Blair in Sedona, Arizona.
Hey,
about,
Blair.
Hi, 200 miles north of Tucson. And hi,
sure
David.
Thing.
Hi, Blair. I was just in Sedona visiting my friend John Dumas.
Oh, very cool.
The musician.
I have a quick comment about the transfiguration, and then, George, one question concerning benign Sirian ozone replenishment. And I think David knows what that's about. According to the Urantia book, the transfiguration was a celestial acknowledgement of Jesus' completion of incarnations in the bodies of those he created, and this resulted in him receiving total sovereignty in this local universe. And if Bible scholars, if they look, after the transfiguration, he started saying, all power in heaven and earth has been granted me. Mm-hmm. But, Mr. Sarita, my question, I've been hearing in the news about new ozone holes that have been recently reported in the media. And I remember when you were on, I think it was with Dan Aykroyd in 2001 on Art's show, you said that the Sirians were propelling balls of ice into our atmosphere and replenishing our ozone. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Well, there was no doubt that NASA, it was Louis A. Frank, who's a National Space Act Award-winning astrophysicist, who's the principal investigator on many of our satellites that are observing the cameras that can see ultraviolet photons, which are invisible. He was detecting ice balls, which were actually water comets that entered our upper atmosphere. They could only see them in the invisible, not in the infrared, which means they were almost non-physical, or what I call zero mass. Transform balls of water, but nevertheless, the water was breaking down, hitting the atmosphere, and as the water is bombarded with intense solar radiation in the upper atmosphere, it separates hydrogen and oxygen. Oxygen goes through further transmutations and turns into ozone. So the head of astrochemistry, Joseph Knuth, confirmed that these balls of water, which they don't know where they are coming from, are producing a certain amount of ozone, but he said probably not enough to heal our Earth's ozone layer problem. But they are producing, you know, quite a bit of ozone, but not enough to repair the damage.
Well, I guess they're taking care of us in the sense that they consider us unfinished experimental beings of some sort, and they're giving us a boost, but then we have to take it from there, huh?
We got to take it from there. It's buying us a little more time, probably, wherever these balls of water are coming from. There's no doubt they're here. This is not metaphysical speculation, and it's not channel information. NASA has confirmed they're here. But the question is it buying us more time? We still have to change our ways. We still have to transform our technology towards more sustainable technologies to keep this as our home.
Great. Hey, thank you, George, for taking my call.
My pleasure, Blair. Let's move to our next wild card line. It's your turn, and where might you be?
Eric from Indianapolis.
Go ahead, Eric.
Okay. Hey, I was wondering why such an excellent theory with that was rejected by scientists, because it would have opened up the possibility of the experiment being replicated on a more open basis, and that it almost goes into the fact that it would allow even for digital compression to even be improved to allow even like a sound wave to almost the infinite sound wave to be brought into that and stored on a computer in a more complete basis than what it is now.
Well, there's no doubt. You see, when you hang around physicists like I have, these guys argue, they yell at each other. They're like kids. They're geniuses. But all they do is fight all day to see who's going to be the next genius, whose theory is going to make the top of the hill. And so that's why good theories get rejected. But good theories, over time, survive and eventually triumph over their predecessors.
And, yes, you have inspired me to even pursue this theory, even on some stuff that I've had, because I've always had a fundamental feeling, even since I was about 5 years old, that there was something wrong with Einstein's theory of relativity.
Mm-hmm. Well, the only thing wrong is that we rely on the speed of light, which is the limitation, and we think it's actually an accurate measurement, but it can't detect all events in the universe in real time. Therefore, it creates time because it is in time. It's a velocity. You end up finding out that all waves are dual pairs that give birth to inertia, which is the slowing down, which is the creation of time. Inertia creates time. If you look at a time wave by itself, it's actually inertia that's causing it to become a wave. In singularity, you're beyond all waves. There is no wave because there's no resistance. Waves are born out of resistance. When two waveforms come together, they form a spiral pair, which causes inertia, which is slowing down. So singularity is the ultimate theory in physics that I've ever seen. I've never seen anything
like it. Yeah, and it does go with a conversation even had with a friend of mine that we've been having for the last couple of years, too, about this. It's just that being able, but even with that, it seems like the closer you can get, it sounds like you almost could be able to manipulate the length of the wave like you have mentioned.
Well, you do. If you can manipulate the wave, that's how you move through time.
That was one of even the theories I had with being able to compress even like a sound wave to be able to get it into a digital compression for that. I do a lot of music, and I have been using analog and spinning analog records because of the fact that you cannot get that full feeling with any digital medium.
No, it's not
out
as warm,
right,
is
now.
It? It's not as warm. It doesn't have that feeling.
No, it does not have that warm feeling, and you have to have that warm feeling to get the emotion out in the music.
See, that's what maybe biophotons will be able to carry more feeling tone than the photons we're using right now with radio waves. I mean, there'll be more feeling. I mean, we have a certain amount of feeling over the radio and over television, but biophotons, I think, are going to be the future.
Thanks for your call, Eric. Isn't it amazing, David, how the various religions do all have similarities
mm-hmm.
to them?
They do.
As if the story was the same, that it just got changed along the way.
Yeah, it's that duality. When the ego is born in duality, it believes it's separate and becomes an island. And the same religion becomes, there must be 400 or 500 schools of Islam. 500 different churches of Christianity. The number 500 is common. Buddhism has 500 schools, four major schools. Christianity is the same. They all are. Jesus said in the Gospels that if Satan's kingdom be divided, how shall it stand? And then he again in the Gospel of Thomas keeps speaking about the undivided. So when you enter the undivided, which is single, there's no more conflict inside of you. You don't believe. God doesn't want us to fight holy wars in his name because he's in singularity. God is oneness. There is no separation, duality. There is no I'm right and you're wrong. That doesn't exist anymore. These terrorists who are fanatics who believe God wants to fight for them, they haven't figured it out yet. They still think this is all about who's got it right and who's got it wrong. And it isn't about that. It's like that old song, there ain't no good guy, there ain't no bad guy, there's just you and me and we just disagree. That's what it's about.
First time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call, David.
Sure thing.
Great show. I really appreciate it. Just wanted to make a couple quick mentions and I'll get right off, like give you more time for others. But I agree with you. I think it is that life is what it is and we just make up names for it to try to justify of something that's already there and has been there forever. I think it's interesting, and was wondering if the previous caller talking about the Kundalini and opening up of your spiritual gateways, almost as it were. David, do you think there's any possibility of a almost forced consciousness of people if certain amounts of strong-willed practicing meditators were able to focus at a same time on a same place? Could we possibly force people to kind of open up their minds and maybe start dispelling this good and evil and start realizing we need to just be what we are and live with it?
Well, what happens is when each brain wave on its own is very weak, it's a low amplitude signal. But if millions and even billions of people think together the same thought, the amplitude increases, and therefore the probability that the desired outcome will be attained will also increase because there's more amplitude to that thought wave. Art Bell's done it on the show himself. I mean, with the fires in Salmon Arm, it got everybody to think rain, and it rained. So if you think together, but the problem with duality, entering the dual state, is everyone is opposed to everyone else. You cancel out all of the energy, and you create so much inertia, resistance, you can't get anything done. You have a great idea because you want to do something, and someone else is opposing you. You want to bring zero-point energy or more solar power and hydrogen, like Schwarzenegger is trying to bring the hydrogen highway in California, and then all the gas companies oppose him. But that's how nothing happens. But when we think together as a nation and as a planet, then the amplitude of our waveforms, our thought forms, is going to manifest because millions of people are thinking together, getting closer to singularity, to oneness.
David, thank you so much for being on the program. I appreciate it.
Thank you, George. It's a pleasure being on with you. I look forward to our next chat.
Absolutely. Absolutely. For Dan Galati, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesour, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.